prepared to take some questions, and we have about 20 minutes, so I'm sure you've all been provoked into responding, and I'll try and, if any magnification of the question is required, as it was meant, I'll try and act as that translator. So do we have questions, please? Yes.
You said that you are pessimistic as a tactic for encouraging people to do something about this, the bleak picture. Does that tactic work?
Do people...
Yes, the pessimism that you're saying it has a function, does it actually work? Does this strategy of painting the pessimistic picture, is it efficacious as a strategy?
There are two concepts coined by Robert Merton in sociology, the relative literature of sociology, self-fulfilling and self-canceling prophecy. Self-fulfilling, very simple, you predict that something will happen and then very many people start behaving accordingly, waiting that to happen, and because they act like that, it's an old truth, it really comes true, it really happens. All hypes are based on this assumption, self-fulfilling prophecy. They describe in vivid, lurid colors the forthcoming event, great event, you know, great feast or great exhibition or great march or whatever, and because they do that, then really people come from all over the world and it really becomes a great event. That happened, for example, to paintings of Vermeer several years ago. Since we live in a culture of forgetting, I don't count on you remembering still this event, because it was 5 or 6 years ago, but it did happen. It so happens that I travel relatively often, and wherever I travel, I see somewhere Vermeer, somewhere in some museum, a local museum. I didn't see any crowds in front of these paintings. But someone with great a large deal of ingenuity, energy, and probably also money, organized tremendous hype all over the world. 28 Vermeer paintings brought together, and there was a pilgrimage. There was a virtual pilgrimage. It became a great event, like it was advertised beforehand. All three premiere reviews of films, Hollywood films particularly, act on the same ground. So it's the nearest, the most banal example of self-fulfilling prophecy. The other is self-canceling or self-destroying prophecy, where you paint some horrifying picture, you warn, well, that's going to happen, and then people stop thinking what to do to prevent this from happening, and it doesn't happen. It doesn't happen. On this ground, the Old Testament prophets acted. You know, they didn't know the term self-canceling prophecy, but they acted as if they did. Maybe they painted such dark pictures of the future that dreaming that because they are so dark, that people will somehow gather their forces, stand shoulder to shoulder, and prevent it from happening. The trouble is, however, that's really a problem, that when you are making prediction, when you are making diagnosis, when you are pointing to tendencies, you never know. There's no way of knowing. You are taking a risk here, because you never know whether it will become self-fulfilling or self-canceling prophecy, and you are absolutely right when you are asking whether it acts like that. I'm far from being convinced that it is guaranteed, assured to act like that. we are all more or less convinced that pollution is a bad thing, right? We are. Pollution of air, pollution of drinking water, it's a disaster. We'll all be against it, there's no question. Make a referendum around the planet and you'll see that 95% of people, 5% of cranks aside, you know, will vote that pollution should be abolished. But then whenever a conference about pollution is organized, about fighting pollution, all participants come in private cars. So that's how it works. We are all against wars. We are all against wars. And the, particularly under conditions of the contemporary worldwide disorder, we are particularly afraid that the war may come at any time, cruel acts, murder, genocide, or whatever. So we are against it, and every politician would tell you that they are very strongly against war in general. They would like to abolish wars. But at the same time, every politician rejoices if in his or her constituency the local weapon factory gets more orders, and book of orders is full, and in case it is not happening, in case there is a threat of redundancy, of course this MP elected in this particular constituency will run to the Prime Minister and use whatever influence he might have to subsidize the ailing factory so that more weapons could be produced and sold. So it acts both ways. However, and I admit quite frankly, I would be very much obliged if someone offers me a better recipe for making it effective. I haven't found any, and I think that in the absence of a better one, this one has to do. That's one thing on which it can count.
Any other question, please?
Sigmund, it appears that many people in the world are not really interested in thinking in the way you think. That a lot of people in the world, I hesitate to say, because one could become racist in saying things, that have a sense of a future which will not be in any way criticised, abandoned, by anything of the kind that you're saying. Now, what you're saying, it seems to me very important. It's very important in our culture that you are saying we must beware of thinking of that anything might happen in the future at all. We can't predict things might happen. But so many other people in the world want to know and think they do know where they're going. Now, how do we confront these two ways of thinking?
What do you mean? You mean the future, well, in the sense of life after death, things like that? Yeah, well, that's extremely important, really. But still, I would argue that. It's a marginal phenomenon in contemporary society, but given to very few. There is a renewal, revival of religiosity and spirituality all over the world, that's true, but in a new form. In a form which is really adjusted to the conditions of contemporary life. It is the liquid water or postmodern form of religiosity. In what sense? First of all, if I watch closely the youth festival, Catholic youth festivals, which happen now regularly, thanks to the initiative of John Paul II, hundreds of thousands of young people come from all over the world,
And I tried to find out how different are these festivals from the pop festivals, for example. They are events. They are carnival events. They are carnival events, perhaps slightly different melodies are played there, but not different in style. The verses not are so far away from country music. So it's carnival event, and carnival event, as we know from great Russian philosopher Mikhail Bakhtin, carnival are there to punctuate the interruption between two stretches of normality. Normality is different from industry. I was particularly shaken in my native country, Poland, what's happened. Poland was particularly in love with John Paul II, as you know, for obvious reasons. When he died, there was a real national mourning. People who were not particularly religious, well, most Poles are, but to the degree unthinkable in Britain. But there were some even less, you know, more lukewarm. Even they pleaded publicly some sort of spiritual conversion. Now we are all being evangelical for our Europe, but follow the scriptures and so on. That was the on Saturday. On Sunday there was a football match between two teams in Krakow, and the undoubtedly Catholic hooligans who the same morning went to church for family killed each other. There were three cops. So you see, carnival, that's what I was playing on, how deep it is. It is not a situation like it was 300-400 years ago when the life, the whole of life, was organized around the logic, the ritual, the continuity of religious involvement. So it is rather punctuated, 20th time again, there's time to give the due to God, and time to give due to things I would say what. The second doubt I have is that very often, if you look how people report themselves, their kind of religiosity, in most cases it's religion a la carte. What I like, I select. That's pleasant. I have a lot of fun, give a kick, this sort of thing. But not with the whole inventory. With something which is inconvenient, no scruples, no really conscience. I don't take it. It's very much like going to a shop, really. What do you like? You buy. I don't like that. I don't buy. That's it. Now, that is post-modern or liquid modern religion. It's not the same. So whether this spirituality will have as profound impact on the logic of daily life, now that's a big question, so I can't answer.
I was just thinking, if...
Could you speak up, please?
Yes, okay, I'll speak up. Okay. If all the information that one might learn at university is going to be out of date the day that one leaves, and if every moment is discrete and therefore one cannot be a reflective practitioner, then should we stop teaching information at university and start teaching these filtering skills instead, since all the information is at our fingertips at the flick of a mouse?
Yeah. Well, there is a thing, Gregory Bateson, there was a very, very important and extremely original and wise anthropologist in the 20th century, and he said that there are three levels of teaching. The first level of teaching is giving information. It's a banal, trivial sort of thing.
You are a wardrobe, I stuff the wardrobe with information, and I keep it there. If I open it during exams, it's all there, the way. That's the first. The second is the teaching of the ability to absorb information, use it, rework, recycle, and so on. And that's tremendously important. I think that the second was the substance of university teaching when I was still a university teacher. Anyway, that's what I wanted to do. You may forget this or other bit of information, but the important point is that your brain is training in the techniques, in the, you know, in the ways of putting it on the assembly line, you know, use the new information. You must, for example, learn in university where to look for information, where to find it, you know, where to go if you want to find something, and so on. But then Gregory Bateson, who wrote 50 years ago, suggested also the third way of education, which, unlike the second level, which is about teaching people to putting information in the frame, arranging it, organizing it, and so on. The third kind consists, he said, in destroying the frames, disassembling the frames, throwing, disrupting them, and replacing with something else, or replacing with nothing. This Eureka kind of thing, suddenly all things look very differently. I forget everything I learned before, the frame I reject, and I try something new. Well, he thought 50 years ago that this third level of education, which produces suspicion towards frames, established ways of handling material, paradigms, and so on, that is a pathological phenomenon. It is disruptive of the development of knowledge, and he warned against it. Well, I think that in contemporary, that's just the hint only. I would sign a blank check for it, but I think that the third level probably now becomes a very important matter of weapon. Equipment, piece of equipment in handling the contemporary information. But be prepared to that certain way of looking at things could be invalidated. They lose their cognitive ability, really. And you have to be able to refront, so to speak, your attention and your perception of things. It's a very provisional, very generalistic. I don't think that any real expert of education will settle for that. They probably have better ideas. But I apologize that I can't teach teachers to teach. I can only say, ask them to think about the kind of a world in which they operate.
Could I ask, leading on from the former question, really, is it relevant anymore to differentiate between this excess of information but something else, knowledge? Is it still relevant to make that distinction, and do universities have a privileged place in doing that anymore?
Well, knowledge, if you want to have knowledge, if you want to, something which really deserves to be called knowledge, then extremely an important element in your acquisition of knowledge is the matter of selection. It's a matter of selection. Something like, Michelangelo, when he was asked how he makes his wonderful, exquisite sculptures, he said, it's so simple, I just take a blob of bamboo and cut away everything which is unnecessary. That's a great, great art, the acquisition of knowledge. That's something which I used to have
students who studied for PhD, their own dissertations, their problem was invariably, almost without exception, that they made their work immeasurably impossible to assimilate, big. They wanted to pack in everything with the 11.
Yeah.
And they saw that the more information, the better. It was unreadable, it didn't express everything, it was just, you know, a stump state for the rubbish bin. And the worst thing, the most difficult thing, was to teach those people it was painful for them. They already collected the information. Now I am asking them to throw it away. it's a crime. But that is exactly what producing a piece of knowledge which would be eligible, readable, assimilable, and they'll give some real useful information which could become part of other perspective. But that is cutting away what's unnecessary, concentrate on relevant. And that's why I was saying in this talk of mine that I think the bottleneck today is the absence of filters. We are overflowed with information which is artificially multiplied. Computers have the ability of multiplying it. Every entry, every visit to a site is an act of multiplication. Don't know, but you are. By every entry you add to pollution of internet with vectors of information. So, but nothing is done in order to select, to cut out. I think that's the threshold which ought to be negotiated and somehow overcome. I won't be here around, but I think that in your lifetime, probably some technological revolution will happen in the field of selection, reduction, simplification, in the field which has been neglected so far.
I mean, if I want to find out about something, say it's a sort of sociological topic on the net,
yeah.
I'll go in and have a look, but then ultimately what I'm doing is looking for the best published academic sources on it.
How do you know which is the best?
just by sort of
process.
Yeah,
that's a question which Google wouldn't understand.
Yeah.
What do you mean best? Best.
Authoritative, I suppose.
They will probably show you some football website if you ask about best. George Bernard Shaw, I remember. Great, he was also a great photographer, an amateur photographer, but very, very good photographer. And he had a metaphor. He said that a photographer is like codfish. A codfish, in order to produce one cod alive, must, how many? 10,000 eggs are necessary in order to. For one cod to be born, to be alive. I'm afraid that production information is acting very much in the same way, the codfish way. Maybe production of excess information, perhaps one bit of it, will be quoted, will be spotted, or will inspire someone, will lead to a research program, will bring some really important information and so on. But it is it is taking risk. It is just playing the game. You don't know what the result will be. It is because of this disentanglement, because of this indifference, because of this inability to set apart relevant from irrelevant, that we are compelled to produce excessive information. Because if we are not sure about the quality, then we have to compensate for the lack of quality or doubtful quality with quantity.
If you produce 1,000, you know, it's like playing lottery. Why do you? When you, you know that your chance is minimal to be to win a prize, but if you buy 1,000,000,000 lottery tickets, then your chance is much bigger. Or if you, or if you make a syndicate with other colleagues, you know.
I think we've time for one more question. Just one more, I think.
Two hands.
Well, mine's very quick. All right, two short questions then.
In 1979, when I graduated, I asked you what I should do. You probably don't remember this. And you said, go into business. And it was when, just after Margaret Thatcher was elected. It was a difficult time.
Are you good?
No. I ignored your advice and it feels very much, as you said, a mess. I'm about to retire. What should I do?
I don't remember advice me going to business. To be sure, I don't remember advising anybody going to
business. Well, you did, because we were walking up by the church. just as this had been built.
Yeah. Yes, but I have no reason to doubt what you said. What I say is, on the one hand, you were a student when I was here teaching.
Yes.
So I am partly responsible for it.
You are. why ask you now?
If I did say go to business, that would turn me the testimony that I was a bad teacher. But if I inspired you to ignore my advice, I was a good teacher. One way or the other, I actually brought you to the same level of Gregory Bateson.
Yes, but I didn't do what my teachers told me.
Yeah. What to do now? Retirement, you mean?
Yeah.
You look very young. But anyway.
That's very kind.
I think that life begins with retirement.
Good.
Yeah. And my colleague in Warsaw agreed with that, but he said that it's simply an organization of society because this best time of life should come at the beginning. When people are full of health, you know, and vigor and so on. But it comes when it's not particularly vigorous. And I said he was wrong. He was wrong because his youngsters won't appreciate it. What a miracle, what a paradise will be retired. They have to have 45, 50 years of employment behind them. I don't really know what that will be. And by my contemporary reckoning, I advise all my friends to retire as soon as possible, and I tell all my enemies to stay. So don't worry about retirement. I don't know enough about your life so far to
I'm a teacher.
It's a question how far you can capitalize on your life so far in retirement. For example, if I was a microbiologist and was to retire from the university, it would be a disaster because I would lose laboratory funds for research, research assistants, and so on, and I can't do anything, be microbiologist or nuclear physicist without access to cyclotron or something like that. But in our profession, which is the humanistic profession, social science, we don't need, fortunately, rats in laboratory, or rabbits, you know, and funds from foundation and so on. And that's why we can do exactly all the best things which attracted us originally to the profession. They have the ability to read, think, talk, teach, discuss, you know, these sort of things, right? We can do it. With minus all the unpleasant things which you need to
do, as long as they employed, for example, writing reports with the assessment committee, applying foundation for funds, sitting on committees which discuss matters, and so on and so on. So on the whole, there's nothing to be afraid of. And again, I send you to Dennis Warwick, because he really is wonderful teacher, and he makes all the premonitions, worries, visions of disaster disappear among people who prepare for it.
Well, I thank you very much indeed, Zygmunt. You've inspired me to look forward to retirement with entirely different eyes. And thank you for all the food for thought you've given us. Now adjourned to the Commonwealth.